Okay. Next talk in this room will now begin. It's by Margaret Field, documenting Kumeyaay dialects in Baja California.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Margaret Field. I teach at San Diego State University. And the dialects that I've been working on recently belong to a language which has a couple of names. Some people call it Kumeyaay. Some people call it Digueño because it's the indigenous language of the San Diego area. Some people call it Ipe, and some people call it Tipe, depending on their perspective and where they are. But I'll explain all of that as I work through my show here. We got funding from NSF's Documenting Endangered Languages program for a three-year project with several goals, including documenting the Kumeyaay. And this is the Spanish spelling of the word Kumeyaay. It's also sometimes spelled in a different way, and you might see that in a couple of places in the show, in case you're wondering. One is the Spanish-Mexican spelling, and the other is the English spelling. To document the Kumeyaay language as spoken in several communities in Baja California, Mexico, to educate members of the community about methods for reversal of language shift, to assist fluent speakers to teach their language using both immersion methodologies and literacy, to create a Spanish Kumeyaay lexicon which reflects local lexical variation, of which there's a great deal, to create pedagogical materials for the Kumeyaay community in Spanish and Kumeyaay, so for the Mexican Kumeyaay community, and to archive all of the digital data collected at UT Austin's Archive of the Indigenous Languages of Latin America for future research, or community use. This is an extremely collaborative project, which depends heavily on direct participation from community members, from planning of workshops held throughout the year to collection of data and including its transcription. One remarkable aspect of the project is the level of community awareness of variation across dialects, which contributes to a relatively genial, non-judgmental, non-competitive atmosphere in which everyone is open to learning about each other's dialect. And this has everything to do with language etiology, which is the area that I've been focusing most of my research on lately, and I will come back to that later in a few minutes. In this picture, you can also see most of the team members of the research team, at least one of them is also a community member. The man sitting at the back of the table is a graduate student in the anthropology department at San Diego State, Mike Wilkin, who's also been living in the Baja community for the last 20 years. He's actually married in, he's not married, but he's related to people who are married into the community. Fluent in Spanish, has been working with people in every one of the six or seven Kumeyaay communities in Baja for over 20 years and knows where all of their houses are, and all this information is extremely important, plus the fact that he can go freely back and forth across the border and speaks English fluently. Next to him is a young woman who's a Mexican graduate student at UNAM in Mexico City, who's been doing research for 3 or 4 years on a related human language, Paipai, which is spoken in the southernmost community where we're doing research, Santa Catarina. So she has contacts in that community. She was already there. It helps a lot that it helps to alleviate jealousies in that community, so we're not going in just to work with the speakers of a dialect of Kumeyaay, or we think it might possibly be a distinct language called Kowalth, because she has already done work with the Paipai speakers in that community, so that helps. And the closest person seated there, the elderly gentleman, Juan Mesa Cuero, was actually born on the United States side of the border, but grew up in San Jose de la Zora, one of the Baja communities, so he is able to go freely back and forth across the border. It's much easier to pay him because he's a U.S. citizen. We can put him on payroll. He can also work with the linguist on this project, who's not myself. I'm pretty much just the administrator and the grant writer, a humanist linguist, Amy Miller, who lives in Santa Barbara and makes trips down to the San Diego area to work with him on the U.S. side of the border. So it's a very collaborative long line of people stretching from about 100 miles south of the border up to about 200 miles north of the border, communicating with each other via technology and sometimes coming together for workshops. So we have community workshops a minimum of 3 times a year. It's looking like we're probably going to have 3 large community workshops a year and several smaller workshops with people who are especially interested in learning how to write or literacy. The goals of these workshops include practicing literacy and teaching methods in Kumeyaay, providing a forum for discussion of dialect variation, language endangerment, and maintenance, to inform community members about the project's progress, to solicit community opinions on materials and their development from the dictionary we're working on to teaching materials. For example, this picture shows one of the meetings we had recently where we worked out some slight changes to the practical orthography which was created for the U.S. Kumeyaay community by Margaret Langdon back in the 1970s. So we're going to change three of the symbols for writers of Spanish. One was a double L for a voiceless L. For Spanish speakers, that's typically the sound Y. So we decided to write it with an LH. This is a map that shows you the exact area in red where we're doing our research and its relation to other Yuman languages. Kumeyaay, also known as Digueño, belongs to the Yuman language family. Linguistic variation within Kumeyaay is widely acknowledged, and previous work has suggested that it may best be described as a continuum of related speech varieties or even distinct languages, the boundaries of which are difficult to identify. Two U.S. dialects of Kumeyaay have previously been described, one by Langdon and one by Miller, who's the linguist who's working with us now, but very little is known about the Baja varieties. From a Kumeyaay perspective, there are two main subgroupings of Kumeyaay people and dialects, a northeastern group called Ipay, or some people pronounce it Ipay, and a southwestern Tipay, or Tipe. Both of these words mean people. This two-part division is at least a century old, given that it was reported in literature from about 1910. We're finding that these two varieties are likely not mutually intelligible, and that the dialect Tipay also has much lexical variation across its many speech communities. A third variety, known as Kualth, spoken in the southernmost community of Santa Catarina, which is shared with Paipai speakers, is only partly mutually intelligible with other Tipay or Tipe dialects. The graphic that I have here comes from the 1970s or 80s, I believe, and a book called Spirit Mountain. And so what we're finding is that if you were going to say that there were distinct languages as opposed to just dialects of Kumeyaay, it's looking there like there are probably three non-mutually intelligible varieties, Ipay or Ipe, Tipay or Tipe, and Kualth, where there were previously it was thought to be just Digueño or Kumeyaay. And this is another map. I think this comes from Margaret Langdon's grammar of the northern dialect, one of the northern dialects from Mesa Grande. It belongs to the Ipay grouping. And this map shows a couple of isoglosses, or language boundaries, the dotted lines. This one up here separates Ipay from Tipe in the United States, and it basically parallels where the San Diego River is. It's pretty much, that's what the geographical barrier is between those two dialects, which makes a lot of sense. And then this southern one is much more arbitrary, this dotted line here. So I think Margaret Langdon was hypothesizing that there was probably another Mexican dialect, which she was not a speaker of Spanish. She didn't really do research down there, although I think Leanne Hinton did do some in La Huerta. And so what we're finding is that rather than saying that there's a large group of dialects all down here which can be considered a Mexican, possibly a separate language, or one variant of Tipe, we're finding instead that the community's classification of the northern speakers Ipe and the southern speakers Tipe is pretty much right on. And that although there's a whole lot of lexical variation across these southern Tipe communities, they're mutually intelligible, except for the dialect spoken at Santa Catarina down here, which seems to be about half Kumeyaay. At least as far as it looks in the dictionary, about half of the words are intelligible to Kumeyaay speakers. This is a comparison of three word lists that I put together at the beginning of this project. These two columns both come from dictionaries that were published. Hamul is from a Tipay dialect, and Margaret Langdon's, I think this was an unpublished dictionary that I got from a local Ipay-speaking tribe. I don't think she published it, but it allows you to compare words in these two dialects of Tipay or Tipe. So these are words that I collected from fieldwork with the elderly gentleman that was in the photo I showed you. And it shows the main thing that it shows you is that there's a much greater amount of variation in the northern Ipay dialect than there is between either of these two dialects of Tipe. So it sort of reinforces that the larger grouping that I was suggesting in the prior slide, saying that instead of a separate Mexican dialect from Tipay, it looks like Tipay extends through most of Mexico. And in particular, what's different is the root of most of the words. They also, a lot of them have lexical prefixes attached. So if you look at the first word for frog, for example, hanya or ha-nya, but han-tak, so the root is different. The lexical prefix is pretty much the same thing. And it's about the same in many, many words. Our study found lexical variation across the Baja communities, including differences in noun or verb roots, as well as lexical prefixes. So here are a few more examples. We found 10 distinct forms meaning my father, 4 sharing the root tat, sometimes it's short, sometimes long vowel, 5 with the root ku. We found 5 different forms for the word head, a widely used form shmu with the root mu, and a related form shemhu, and 3 forms sharing a root kur. We found 6 distinct forms for the word small. I'm not sure exactly how many had which of these roots, but some had the root peach and some had the root ow. We also found differences at various levels of the grammar, including 3 partially distinct negative constructions, differences in switch reference marking, and different demonstrative clinics. So this is a slide that will hopefully look something like what our lexicon will look like in the end, although it will be in Spanish in Kumeyaay instead of English. So the acronyms or the initials that you see in parentheses there stand for each of the Baja communities. So La Huerta, San José de los Zora, Juntas de Nejí, San Antonio Necua, San José de Tecate. The K stands for Kualth. And in most of these examples, although I'm not sure that this will be true of most of the words in the lexicon, but in most of these examples, the different roots always are in the Kualth dialect. Although the lexical prefixes are just sort of all over the place. And so this also shows that we hope that we will be able to provide an example of the word occurring in natural discourse for every word, for every entry. Lexical dialects are found in much of native California, as well as indigenous Australia. For example, Gola has suggested that in the San Joaquin Valley of Central California, there may once have been as many as 40 distinct dialects of Yokuts, with a shared vocabulary seldom greater than 50%, some sharing as little as 25% of their lexicons. Cultural mechanisms leading to this kind of intense lexical replacement may include tabooing of everyday items linked to certain animals or food sources, as well as death, but also may be connected to what Jane Hill has called a localist group identity or stance, or what Paul Croscurdy has called a variationist language ideology. And a localist group identity or stance or ideology Hill suggests is typically linked to access to resources in a community. So that's not true anymore, at least in Baja. It's not true that having a distinct dialect helps you maintain access to local food resources, for example. However, north of the border, it is still very true that localist identity is linked to resources, and that has everything to do with sovereignty and cultural sovereignty. So part of the definition of cultural sovereignty is your language. And so tribes that speak Kumeyaay north of the border have a very different attitude, and I think it has everything to do with politicization, which is a hard word to say, as well as access to resources. So for example, getting funding from the federal government to document your language, or you wouldn't want to say your particular dialect, but your distinct language and your community. It helps to be able to have a localist perspective on your language. Well, people in Baja have a very different attitude today, although they might once have had resources connected to their local dialects. Today, they have a much more open stance. And they also have this variationist language ideology, which privileges or has as a norm an expectation that every family is going to have a slightly different dialect. Every community is going to have a different dialect. Every local speech community is going to have a different dialect, rather than an orientation to a standard or a norm or something that you see going on in most Indo-European speech communities. We found that the keepers of the language were definitely women. We found 58 speakers altogether. More than half of them were female. All of them are over 45 years old, but many of them are in their 40s, or six or seven of them are in their 40s, which is a lot for us compared with the situation on the northern side of the border. We found most of them living in San Jose de los Zora, which is a fairly large community, but pretty far down south, which means that we have to have workshops sometimes in the south and sometimes in the north as two central magnets, and then try to bus people in or arrange carpools. Our data collection is done with Sony Handycams with shotgun mics attached. We are, the two grad students in the field have laptops. They go out with video cameras and also with solid-state recorders, recording in MPEG-4 with WAV format, and then using iMovie, they compress those movies a little bit onto DVD, give the DVDs to me. So they have to make their way up across the border to me. I then copy them. I send them to the linguist in Santa Barbara. And I'm the one who reviews them to try to flesh out what exactly, what is the content of these videos while she's entering them into a linguistic database. The original WAV file formats, WAV format files, are also going to be backed up onto hard drives, external hard drives, for archiving purposes. This is the metadata form, which is often just filled out verbally at the beginning of the interview. Some of the pertinent information is genealogical. The part that's always the least fleshed out is the summary of data recorded, which is my main role in this entire job, besides making sure that people get paid, is listening to the data, trying to keep up with it, and trying to annotate what is on each of these DVDs that comes to me. Intellectual property rights are also an interesting question, in that most of the people in these communities are illiterate, don't speak English, don't have electricity, and have very little idea what the internet is. So it's very different from the situation that we were just talking about in the session prior to this one, or talk prior to this one, where people are much more savvy about intellectual property and that sort of thing. People in Mexico, it's really hard to try to explain to people what you're going to do with the data when they have no idea what things like the internet are. Types of data that we're collecting. We're starting out with word lists and asking people to give us example sentences for each word. It's a good starting point, especially it's a good starting point for members of the community who are going out with tape recorders. We have two people doing this now, recording each other. It's just an easy place to start. It's also an easy place for them to start transcribing. It's also an easy kind of data to enter into a lexicon. We're also collecting stories, narrative, relatively easy to transcribe compared with conversation. However, not everybody is a storyteller. Conversation, we have one conversation from the Santa Catarina community that's about half an hour long, an extremely rich source of interactional information, very difficult to transcribe. So the graduate student, who is also a linguist in Mexico City, is working on that. We also hope to have a lot more task-focused talk. We haven't gotten that far yet. But we plan to include talk that discusses ethnobotany, pottery, and basketry, all traditional activities. This requires video recording. It's much harder to control ambient sound. The wind gets in the way, especially when you're out looking at plants and bushes and things. An excellent source of cultural knowledge, and we think it will be very attractive for building multimedia language lessons later. This is a sample of video, but I only have 2 minutes left, so I don't think I want to... You can't quite hear it.
Negro es pil. Pil es negro. Pil.
But you can get, you know, the MPEG-4 format works pretty well. And even though AAC sound format is not quite as good as WAV, you can still hear it pretty well. This is one main transcription issue we had. One equipment issue we've had is that when I originally envisioned this project, the way I thought it would work is that I would take digital files that we had collected in WAV format and then turn them into analog files and burn them onto audio cassettes and give people a bunch of Panasonic tape recorders or even foot pedal transcribers, which is the last thing that I used to do transcribing when I was working on my dissertation back in the 90s. Well, you can't find those things anymore. The multimedia lab at the university doesn't even have the equipment that allows you to go backwards from digital format to analog format anymore. You used to be able to take your digital stuff, plug in stuff into this machine that would burn the digital information back into analog format and put it on an audio cassette for you. Well, they don't have that anymore. So the closest thing I could find to a cheap Panasonic recorder is this little Zoom recorder, which I think is This is exactly what the conference is using to record these talks. It's only about $150, and as opposed to the Etterol solid-state recorder that we're using to record the original data, these ones, which we'll give to community members for playback, for transcription, they let you count the seconds when you go back. So when you hit the back button, you can actually see the seconds going back, and you don't have to always go back to the beginning of the track, which is what the solid-state recorders want to do. So it took a little bit of snipping around, but the guys at B&H were very helpful. And then this is my last slide. One of the main foundational ideas of this whole project was that we are going to both empower the language and the community, revitalize the language and empower the community, because one of the main goals is to assist them to become language teachers, and the main audience that we have in mind are members of the Kumeyaay community who live in the United States, north of the border, because the language is almost gone. There's only a handful of speakers left north of the border. In fact, I think there are fewer than five. They're all in their 80s or older, and they don't exactly feel like teaching language classes. None of them have been involved in anything like that. So there is a summer field school that's been going on for the last 2 or 3 years where students from northern communities get bused down for the day to learn how to do things like, you know, basket making and pottery. So we want to extend that into an overnight experience that would maybe last a week and basically have an immersion field school in San Jose de los Zora. So this picture gives you some idea of the really intense poverty that's going on down there. The situations between the Kumeyaay communities north and south of the border, it's just like night and day, totally black and white. And that's my last slide. So thank you very much. Any questions?
I had a question.
Yeah.
How did you, it sounds like you're all at different places and the students are not, it sounds like not all your students.
They're not my students.
Not any of your students. How did you all kind of hitch up?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'm in the Department of American Indian Studies, which is a very small department. We only just got a major of American Indian Studies, where previously we only had a minor. But I do a lot of interaction, and I teach sometimes for the Department of Anthropology. So I also, you know, being in American Indian Studies, I do a lot of community outreach type stuff, and I've been keeping an eyeball on what's going on with Kumeyaay language efforts since I came for the last 8 years. So I knew that Mike Wilkin, who is the American guy who's living down in Baja for the last 20 years, had just joined the anthropology department and became a graduate student. So I knew that he was going to be available to hire with grant money. And he and I had also had a lot of long discussions about how we could get something like this going. I also knew that Amy Miller, the humanist, was just wrapping up a grant project working on Kokopa, a related language, and that she was going to be unemployed very soon. And so, you know, like the stars just came together, and I thought, all right, this is the time to write this grant because we can hire both of these people, and I'll just be the administrator. I'll learn a lot about what's going on in the process.
You said you had students from Mexico City, too.
Oh, and Mike knew about Elena,
who
has been working in Santa Catarina for the last 3 or 4 years. So she's just wrapping up her master's thesis on Pai-Pai phonology.
What's the relationship like between the people in Baja and the people in Southern California? Is there a lot of talk back and forth? Is it
you know, the language barrier between Spanish and English is really a barrier. So there's not a lot of talk back and forth. There's a limited amount of interaction, which pretty much is limited to people from the Baja community coming up to sell stuff at powwows. And some other events, like there's a human language summit. They've been coming up with Mike Wilkin, who drives people back and forth and arranges to take them to things like the human language summit and all kinds of different cultural events. They even host some down in Baja that a few people from the northern communities attend. But most of the visiting takes place on the U.S. side of the border and has everything to do with selling cultural wares. So there hasn't been a lot of interaction. It's mainly because of the Spanish-English language barrier.
Yeah, I was going to follow up. One of the problems is in having dispersed communities is creating awareness of what the other is doing in terms of the language work. And once the interest gets started, there is a willingness or effort made to just come together on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Is this happening in this case?
Well, it's usually the people from Baja going up to northern communities. There's been less of a willingness for northern communities to travel down to these very impoverished communities, except for the summer field school thing, which is just a one-day event that a couple of communities send their kids on a bus a couple of times. There is, however, there's a little bit of interaction that has to do with the Master Apprentice Program. So the elderly gentleman who was in the picture, who is an American citizen, has been an elder in the has been a master in the Master Apprentice Program for a few years now, and he trained somebody who's also an American citizen and a member of the Northern Kumeyaay community. That guy married a woman from San Jose de la Zora, I think. So there's been some interaction through the Master Apprentice Program, and so we're hoping that we can get the people who were trained to do immersion language teaching, Juan's student, who's also very busy because he's got other jobs and he's in the Navy and I don't know what else. But we're hoping to hire him on this project to go down and teach immersion teaching methodologies, because that will help overcome the Spanish-English language barrier. Right. Yeah.
I'm very impressed by the way that you're paying so much attention to all the dialects that you've been able to find, finding examples of words from all dialects. But I was just curious, were there any attitudes along the lines of the way we speak is correct, the way we speak is strange?
You know, it's really interesting, and even when I wrote the 300 words for this conference, the abstract for this conference, I thought we were going to encounter a lot more of that kind of thing, because in the past I've worked on Navajo and I've worked with northern Kumeyaay communities in the U.S., and that's pretty typical, but we haven't found that at all. And you know, that's what I said in one of the first slides, is that we've found this amazingly open attitude on the part of everybody from these Baja communities, because they have this expectation that they're not going to understand all of the words in the village right next door. They're used to that. And there are so few members now that we have like maybe two people from each one of these communities, and there's just not a lot of posturing for you know, being a good speaker as opposed to a more you know, semi-speaker or something like that.
Do you think that has to do with the economics of it? The fact that, well, there is no funding for anybody, so there's no reason to be a better speaker than...
I think it would be very naive to leave economics and economic motivation out of the entire picture. You know, when I said that there is access to resources for northern communities, that has everything to do with economics too. And then people in Baja don't have that going on. So emphasizing differences between their village dialects doesn't lead to funding coming from the Mexican government, right? So that motivation goes right out the window. That people have been really open to sharing with each other, and we're going to end up with a dialect that has all of these different, a dictionary that has all of these different dialects in it, and people are happy with that, so it's fortunate.
I wonder about how the communities, this large mutual unintelligibility, whether the communities themselves self-identify as being one cultural group or with various, I mean, you say that they accept that there's difference between the different groups. Do they set, do they see themselves as speaking dialects of language or different languages or being of one more relatively cohesive group compared to other groups like Pai Pai, for example?
They pretty much envision themselves as belonging to those three groups,
right.
Tipai, Ipai. The people in Baja have a very vague conception of what Ipai is, who Ipai people are and the Ipai dialect is, because they've never been up that far to the northern half of San Diego County, right? But, you know, when we show them words or, you know, we don't have any speakers to bring to them, but we try to pronounce them for them, they're like, nope, we have no idea what that is, you know, like the three columns that I showed you guys, none of them were familiar with any of the words from the Mesa Grande dialect. So if you explain to them, yeah, this is the dialect that people speak, the northernmost Kumeyaay communities, some of the people, like the gentleman who lives on the U.S. side of the border, he's gotten around to almost every community. He's very aware that he doesn't understand people in those northern tribal communities. So I don't think they're aware that there's the San Diego River and there's an isogloss, but they know that there are the northernmost communities, which they really can understand. But then otherwise, all other Tipai speakers, they can work it out, just like, you know, people from Tennessee could work it out with people from Australia after a couple of days, or people from Scotland. You know, there's a lot of lexical variation. You say tomato, I say tomato, couch, Davenport, but And it's just really intense. It's like every tenth word. But otherwise, they can understand each other, yeah. And then everybody agrees that Kwalth is something completely different. But they can halfway get it. They can kind of understand it, but it's really different.
Other questions? Thank you.
Well, thank you. So we're leaving this unplugged.
Oh.
Here you go.
Thank you.
Right, yeah, because I was about to come. I was happy to see you. You know, when you're presenting, that's great.